I was equally shocked and relieved when I discovered that Americans don't have the unhealthiest breakfast. The English win the oddest and unhealthiest breakfast award for the traditional English breakfast, which for some reason includes baked beans. That's right, baked beans, with all their undesirable side effects, are consumed first thing in the morning in England. The other items in a traditional English breakfast include a fried egg, a fried piece of toast, a stewed tomato, a sausage link, and a strip of bacon, and a piece of fatty ham. Yes, the traditional English breakfast, for some reason, includes all the breakfast meats. This makes the Denny's Grand Slam breakfast look like a bowl of cut fruit in comparison. I've heard that waking up and smoking a pack of cigarettes is better for you than a traditional English breakfast. Irish breakfast. The traditional Irish breakfast includes many of the traditional English breakfast items, plus something called black pudding, which is most definitely not pudding. It never even was pudding, or anything close to pudding, and that is extremely obvious upon first sight. Black pudding appears to be a sliced, oversized sausage-shaped thing with something that looks like seeds in it. Apparently, the black in black pudding is a reference to blood, which I always understood should be colored red, not black, unless it is the blood from a zombie or an otherwise undead creature. There is also a white pudding, which is also not a pudding, or white, or made from blood. Scientists worldwide are still trying to decipher the molecular composition of white pudding. Personally, I think it's made from ghosts. The Irish might be unfairly associated with drinking too much, but whoever decided to call black pudding, or white pudding, was definitely drunk. Let's call that stuff pudding. No, I'm not drunk. Okay, I had one drink every 2 minutes for an hour. It's black. Call it black pudding. The other one, oh, call it white pudding. Can I pass out now? Breakfast in bed. Breakfast in bed is a glorious fantasy for me, and not just because I'm a fan of lying down and eating bacon, which I believe is how people kill time in heaven. Breakfast in bed is such an amazing concept because it gives you the option of going right back to sleep when you are finished eating.
Well, it would be rude to eat and run, right? Wake me up when lunch is ready.
I'm always amazed there aren't restaurants with beds instead of tables.
We'd like a bed for two with a view of the TV if you have it.
I think the ultimate experience is lying in bed and watching TV while people bring me food on a tray. It's too bad hospitals have that whole sickness requirement thing. If it weren't for that minor detail, I would check into the hospital mañana.
What are your symptoms? I'm hungry and I could go for a nap. Stat.
You can't turn down breakfast in bed. If you see someone walking into your bedroom with a tray of food in the morning, it is impossible to say, "Sorry, I just ate." Although that is usually true for me. The bagel, my everything. I have loved living in New York City for the past 20 years. Everything has happened here. I started stand-up comedy, met my wife Jeannie, and became the father of a basketball team in New York City. The energy, the people, Broadway, Central Park, and even the subway still captivate me. But probably my favorite part of New York City is the bagel. I realize saying New York City has the best bagels is a bit of a cliche, but there is something truly special about a New York City bagel. Maybe it's the water, maybe it's purely a psychological phenomenon, but bagels taste different in New York City. I wasn't always a bagel snob. Back in Indiana, I could go through a sleeve of frozen Lender's bagels before they were even thawed. As a college student in Washington, D.C., I worked in a cafe and discovered the masterpiece that is a cinnamon raisin bagel with cream cheese and bacon. But it was in New York City that I received my bagel education. I gained respect for the power and the art of the New York City bagel. Bagels in New York City are more dense, more flavorful, and when toasted, develop this crunchy outer crust that becomes its own entity. When you bite through that crunchy outer layer and experience the warm, chewy insides of a New York City bagel, you will become a believer too, and you will forsake all other bagels. Bagels outside of New York now just taste like stale, round rolls with holes in them. They feel like the bootleg DVD of bagels. As a struggling new comedian in New York City, late at night I would often shuffle defeated into H&H Bagels on 2nd Avenue after a less than stellar show a block away at the Comic Strip Comedy Club. The scent of bagel perfection was like a comforting welcome from an old friend. I'd meekly ask, "What's hot?" And then I would be handed happiness in the form of the freshest, hottest bagel in New York City. Eating the delicious bagel was like a reassuring hug, telling me that even if the audience didn't get me, the bagel did. The bagel knew how to make me happy. Bombing so often at the Comic Strip allowed me to drown my frustration in freshly baked versions of every traditional variety of bagel. Sometimes I'd get butter or cream cheese on the almost too hot to hold bagel, but often I would just consume it au naturel. During those early years, H&H Bagels was a shield from the awkwardness of figuring out stand-up comedy, a safe haven where I could escape from the harsh rejection I felt at the club. A bagel even sort of looks like a shield, a delicious shield you can hold up in front of you with your finger in the hole and nothing bad can happen. Holding my bagel shield, I was like the little Dutch boy saving the village of my ego from the flood of audience disinterest. I've never been the same. Now my daughters go to school on the Upper East Side, and going to Tall Bagels has become my reward for getting up early and transporting them to the other side of Manhattan while barely conscious. Now whenever I make it to the Upper East Side, which at that hour feels like I've traveled to another planet, I feel like I've earned a bagel. I heard someone talking on the phone describing a delicious, gluten-free New York City bagel, and it made me angry. How dare you call that a New York City bagel? I know New York City bagels. Well, I've eaten a whole bunch of them, and there is no such thing as a delicious, gluten-free bagel. I just shook my head, sneered at my wife, and walked away and got something to eat. Bagels are pretty much universally loved. Everyone has their bagel of choice. Mine is the everything bagel. The everything bagel is a toasted mixture of poppy seeds, sesame seeds, onion, garlic, and salt. I like all bagels, but an everything bagel is something more than special to me. I love my children, but I can't articulate the depth of feelings I have for a toasted everything bagel with cream cheese. They say you can't be everything to someone, but I think the everything bagel is my everything. If reincarnation is real, I'd like to come back as an everything bagel. Then I could guarantee that I'd be loved. I've recently decided that the next time I have to cry in an acting scene, I'm going to imagine a world without New York City everything bagels. What a horrible world that would be. Donuts. The circle of life.
Cops love donuts. Cops and donuts, they go together like, well, donuts and cops.
I find this an interesting stereotype, because you know who else loves donuts? Absolutely everyone.
Yeah, we'll get those cops back for having power by saying they love that thing everyone else loves.
Of course cops love donuts, because they know the difference between right and wrong. And not liking donuts is wrong. Have you ever met someone who doesn't like donuts? Of course not, because those people are in jail. The cops probably caught them murdering puppies because they never knew the love of the donut. As ridiculous as the cop donut cliche is, I will admit that I'm always excited when I see a police officer in a donut shop. I feel as though an angel has just gotten its wings. Maybe I'm just high from the smell of the donuts. Many mysteries surround donuts. I think it was Plato who struggled over the question, what is the difference between seeing a donut and wanting to eat a donut? The answer is, of course, 1 second. We all know seeing a donut happens occasionally. Wanting a donut is a continuous desire. See, now even you want a donut. I had a donut recently. I was with a friend, Tom, and we were walking by a donut shop, and I asked if he wanted to get a donut. He responded that he wasn't hungry. Understandably, I replied, what does that have to do with it? As if there has ever been a good reason to eat a donut.
My doctor says I need more powdered sugar in my diet. Well, another day on the donut cleanse.
Everyone knows donuts are bad for you. Whenever I eat a donut, I always think to myself, looks like I'll never know what it's like to be a grandpa. Of course, I am aware that donuts are bad, horrible things to eat, and according to my health nut wife, they're not appropriate for a trail mix. I repeatedly tried to explain to Jeannie that I'm on a different trail. Mine leads to the emergency room. Trail mixes have nuts, and my favorite nut is most definitely a donut. There is no nutritional value in a donut. There may be the odd study that found somehow that chocolate and wine could help you live longer, but no one even contemplates doing a study about the donut. The donut is all about taste. In Los Angeles, there is a donut shop chain named Yum Yum Donuts. The name cuts right to the chase. I suppose you need an IQ of maybe 2 to understand the concept.
Yum Yum? Me like Yum Yum?
I imagine their target audience is cavemen.
Me no yellow fireball rising sky and Yum Yum Donut.
Dunkin' Donuts. You can't really discuss donuts in the United States without bringing up the omnipresent Dunkin' Donuts. Many cities have their own local donut shop or chain, but they usually also have a Dunkin' Donuts. In New England, Dunkin' Donuts is not just a local favorite. It is ingrained in the New England provincial identity. Dunkies is a favorite son. It seems like New Englanders view that donut shop like a relative or a childhood friend. Dunkies is awesome. It's wicked awesome. They are so passionate and vocal at times, it makes me question whether Dunkin' Donuts is making donuts or playing for the Red Sox. I like Dunkin' Donuts, and judging from the fact there is a Dunkin' Donuts on every city block in most major cities of the United States, I am not alone. This is not to say that Dunkin' Donuts shops aren't the most appealing destinations. I don't think I've ever been to a Dunkin' Donuts that didn't have a homeless guy standing in front of it. It's possibly part of the design plans. I picture the architect showing his model to a prospective franchisee.
There will be an entrance here with a deranged lunatic standing here.
Maybe they find the lunatic first. Hey, there's a guy living in a cardboard box who's yelling about the end of the world. Why don't we put a Dunkin' Donuts there? Either way, there's always some character standing at the entrance of Dunkin' Donuts, serving as a freelance Ronald McDonald. Welcome to Dunkin' Donuts. Can you spare some change? Dunkin' Donuts may be the most successful donut chain, but all donut shops are generally an interesting concept. It's almost as if Alcoholics Anonymous opened their own restaurant. What should we have at our place? Coffee, donuts, maybe a little honesty, and definitely a place to smoke outside. I never really understood how Dunkin' Donuts stays in business. Of course they sell coffee, but even if they sell 3,000 donuts in one day, what would they make, $30? Additionally, whenever I go into Dunkin' Donuts, it seems like they're always trying to get rid of the donuts. Allow me to recount my recent visit to Dunkin' Donuts. Me, I'll have 6 donuts. That'll be $3, but if you get a dozen, it's a nickel. A nickel more? No, just a nickel. I heard a rumor that if you get 2 dozen donuts, Dunkin' Donuts will give you $5. Okay, fine, maybe they aren't paying us to eat them. But it does seem like Dunkin' Donuts is trying to get us addicted to donuts. Whenever I buy a couple of donuts for the family, well, for me, really, the Dunkin' Donuts lady always throws in some munchkins for free. Munchkins are like the gateway donut, like a classic drug dealer. Dunkin' Donuts follows the first time is always free rule. At some point during my adult life, Dunkin' Donuts absorbed the ice cream parlor Baskin-Robbins. Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin-Robbins are a marriage made in obesity. I guess the marketing idea was that Dunkin' Donuts could finally offer dessert. Krispy Kreme. Over the past decade or two, donuts have witnessed a rebirth in popularity. When I was a kid, a donut seemed like this unattainable item that grown-ups would eat in offices and occasionally at gatherings after church. While that hasn't changed at all, donuts do seem more popular. We all witnessed the Krispy Kreme wave as it overtook the nation and then suddenly disappeared. At first, Krispy Kremes were so popular that several years ago, some friends of ours, Chris and Emily, gave out entire boxes of Krispy Kremes as the parting gift at their wedding. I ate the whole box on the way home. Biting into a Krispy Kreme is a unique experience. The donuts melt in your mouth so easily that for a short time, I tried to convince Jeannie they were liquid. I'm thirsty. I think I'll have a donut. Then out of nowhere, Krispy Kreme donut shops disappeared. Of course, they didn't completely disappear, but their presence diminished significantly. It is possible that a group of district attorneys threatened a class action lawsuit. Portland. Many American cities have great donut shops, but Portland, Oregon seems to have a vibrant donut obsession. I don't know if this has to do with its geographic proximity to coffee-obsessed Seattle, or its, well, let's just say late-night eating culture. Whenever I announce I'll be performing in Portland, my Twitter feed is peppered with advice to go to Voodoo Donuts. Often the comments are not suggestions, but demands. You have to go. If you don't go, I'll kill you. The actual word voodoo means something like mysterious forces or powers that govern the world and the lives of those who reside within it, which is pretty much the same way I feel about the power of an actual donut. Voodoo Donut has a donut called Captain My Captain that has Captain Crunch cereal on top of a donut. I call it the Mutiny of My Diet Donut. At Voodoo, I always get the maple bacon donut and then nap in the cab back to my hotel. Well, it's more of a passing out in a sugar coma than a nap, but you get the idea. Not to play favorites in destroying my health. I must also add that Voodoo Donut is not the only donut shop that Portland is known for. There is also Coco Donuts. At Coco's, I always get a lavender donut so I can feel fat and fresh. Tim Hortons. I love Canada, and Canada loves Tim Hortons. I'm no Canada expert, but I know they like their hockey, poutine, and Tim Hortons. Tim Hortons is the Canadian version of Dunkin' Donuts, or maybe Dunkin' Donuts is the American version of Tim Hortons. Either way, I'm applying for dual citizenship. Gourmet Donut Shops. Gourmet Donuts. Yes, Gourmet Donuts. I believe they are deep-fried in gold. We can't stop dressing up junk food. It started with the boutique cupcake shops. Now we have gourmet donuts? It's an evolution. I can't wait for the sloppy Joseph. What will bored rich people eat next? Specialty or gourmet donut shops now can be found in most major cities. I'm not sure how anything deep fried can be that gourmet. Gourmet donut shops are a perfect destination for those of us who want to waste money while we gain weight. I recently purchased a gourmet donut. At the time, I didn't realize I was buying a gourmet donut. I was in a donut shop. I suppose being in a donut shop never really leads to a healthier, smart purchase. You never hear, I was in a donut shop and I found these great probiotics. Anyway, there I was in a donut shop. I pointed at a square donut and told the donut guy, I'll have the square donut. As he started to ring it up on the cash register, he said, that'll be $3.99. I politely said, oh no, I only want one. He then, in a matter-of-fact manner, informed me, that is the price of one. At that moment, there was a long, awkward pause, where the donut guy stared blankly at me, and I waited for him to lean forward and say, just kidding. But he didn't. He just looked at me with a smug smile that said, got you, tubby. He knew I would pay for the donut because I was in a donut shop, and it's not like I was there to buy a yoga mat. Like the great philosopher Plato, he knew the difference between seeing a donut and eating a donut is but 1 second. House of Carbs. A very important subsegment of the restaurant industry is breakfast restaurants. Well, I call them breakfast restaurants. Many of my single friends enjoy going out to fancy places for breakfast or brunch on weekends. They meet up, gossip, and giggle about the adventures they had the night before. I'm not talking about those places. I'm talking about the breakfast restaurants where I can take my 5 screaming children, feed them for around $20, while I witness them do around $40 worth of damage to the establishment. These are usually chain restaurants that serve other meals besides breakfast, but breakfast made them famous because it's the only thing anyone wants to eat there. You are more likely to get the pancakes than the veggie burger at IHOP. You'd rather go to Denny's for a Grand Slam breakfast than the avocado salad. You get the idea. I seem to be in chain breakfast restaurants either in the morning with my screaming children or late at night after shows with slurring adult children. It's really not that different of an atmosphere. IHOP. The most famous breakfast restaurant chain is probably IHOP, which seems like a strange name for a place. Whenever I've eaten at IHOP, I never really feel like hopping. I can barely move feels more appropriate. Maybe I need a wheelchair. The IHOP is famous for its pancakes, yet the entire restaurant seems like a syrup exhibit. Every table in the IHOP is equipped with its own caddy filled with an assortment of syrups. maple, strawberry, blueberry, butter pecan, and boysenberry. Each of the syrup containers is personally licked by a similar assortment of 5-year-olds. As a result of the syrup being pre-placed on the table, there is not an inch of an International House of Pancakes that has not been touched by syrup, even the bathrooms. To prepare for the next morning, at the end of the night, an IHOP employee even mops the floor with syrup. Waffle House. My favorite of the breakfast restaurant chains is Waffle House. Waffle House is similar to the International House of Pancakes, but instead of pancakes, they serve waffles. I'm not sure if it's intentional, but the Waffle House vibe feels more like that of a halfway house or a mobile home than an actual house. I'll never forget the first time I walked into a Waffle House. It was in Tampa, Florida in 1989, and all I could think was, wow, I owe the IHOP an enormous apology. The moment you enter most Waffle Houses, you get the sense that the staff stopped caring a long time ago, or never did. You'll never hear, "Nice job cleaning up," in a Waffle House. If you've never had a chance to visit a Waffle House, simply imagine a gas station bathroom that serves waffles. That sums up the atmosphere pretty well. I love everything about the Waffle House experience, and not just because watching someone fry an egg while they smoke a cigarette reminds me of my dad. I love how the waitress approaches the table with an attitude that says, "Okay, I'll pretend to be your server before I go back to the kitchen and pretend to be your chef." I mostly go to Waffle House after midnight with comedian friends following shows, when the clientele is at its ripest. Many of the patrons are drunk, which explains why there are pictures of food on the menu. I'm not sure how drunk someone would have to be to not remember what a waffle looks like. Oh yeah, it's like a plaid pancake. The folks in a Waffle House after midnight are a motley bunch of 20-year-olds, Vietnam vets, and elderly couples ignoring each other. It feels a little like a family reunion for me, or maybe a white trash convention. Waffle House is so filled with white trash, it actually makes the International House of Pancakes appear international. Everyone seems to be dressed in camo, on the verge of passing out or muttering into a coffee cup, regretting the past 20 years of their lives. It's like you walked into a scene out of The Deer Hunter. I've seen a gun up close 5 times in my life, and 3 of them were in a Waffle House. There is always an air of danger after midnight in a Waffle House. The Waffle House sign with its individual block letters is even reminiscent of a ransom note. Occasionally there will be a letter burned out in the electric Waffle House sign, so the sign will read Awful House. You never hear of anything good happening at a Waffle House after midnight. Another disease was cured at Waffle House last night. Even the hash brown section of the Waffle House menu reads like a serial killer to-do list, smothered, covered, diced, and scattered. Despite all these unbecoming attributes, Waffle House is where so many nocturnal folks, including myself, seem to go for a late-night meal. The Waffle House slogan should really be, "It's 2 a.m., there's still time to make one more bad decision." The celebration of food. Everyone seems to gain weight during the holidays. Unfortunately, the way I eat, I often find myself gaining weight for the holidays. The positive spin on my approach is that it makes the holiday weight gain seem less dramatic. As we all know, holidays are special days to commemorate historical and cultural events or famous dead people. For some reason, we typically celebrate these events or honor these dead famous people by overeating on holidays. To clarify, I'm talking about holidays in the American sense of the word, because for some reason people in the British Commonwealth call any vacation a holiday, which is weird and somewhat annoying, but it actually applies here too. Because on a holiday, a day, not a vacation, we eat like we are on vacation, a holiday for you English-speaking foreigners. This is what you call a cross-cultural reference. I don't know why a holiday or a vacation naturally leads to overeating. Maybe we feel we've earned it. Well, I feel like I've earned it. Don't judge me. You're the one listening to a book on food. On a way, holidays chronicle my unhealthy living throughout a given year. First quarter. I start off the year with the best intentions. It's a new year filled with hope and possibility. I resolve to lose weight, live healthier, and overall be more like Oprah. In almost reactionary behavior to December, I stumble through January, somberly observing Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and contemplating who is actually attending those white sales on President's Day. It seems to be going along nicely until the first Sunday in February. The first attack on my impressive few weeks of somewhat healthy living is Super Bowl Sunday. Well, not an official holiday. The Super Bowl provides the strongest competition to Thanksgiving on the food overconsumption front. Unlike Thanksgiving, there is no facade of gratitude or family time. It's all about football and food. Thanksgiving may go food, then football, but Super Bowl Sunday is simply eat food, watch football while you eat food, and then eat more food. The food served on Super Bowl Sunday is all handheld and makes the Thanksgiving meal look like a health shake. It's like a college fraternity catered a funeral. Buffalo wings, pigs in the blanket, chips, and guacamole are usually the healthiest offerings. And this is right and good. After all, it is called the Super Bowl, not the diet plate. Barely guilt-ridden after my Super Bowl binge, I'll slog through early February with its horrible weather and no football and brace for Valentine's Day. Around Valentine's Day is when I really lose my way. The fatigue of winter has set in. And even though, by some miracle, I am in a relationship, the awkward romance pressure of Valentine's Day seems to prompt unjustifiable chocolate consumption. Valentine's Day seems to be a day shaped to create failed expectations. The whole idea of a day constructed around romance seems counterintuitive. It's like a surprise birthday party that you know about and aren't in the mood for. You can stop a surprise birthday party, but you can't stop Valentine's Day. Everything seems a little forced on Valentine's Day. This is even evident in the amount of candy consumed. One of the Valentine's Day traditions is giving each other those big red heart-shaped boxes filled with the gamble chocolate. I've never eaten any chocolate out of those big red hearts with any confidence. I always think, this could either be really good or totally nasty, but I'm just pig enough to find out. I usually get the piece filled with the pink toothpaste. Then, naturally, I have to eat another 9 to get rid of that flavor. There seems to be no logic in why certain chocolates were included in the heart-shaped box. One time, I'm pretty sure I bit into a chocolate-covered acorn. Valentine's Day also offers the tiny chalk, heart-shaped antacids that are one of the few things that make unsweetened baking chocolate seem appealing. I know I make you nauseous, so here's a Tums with Hug Me written on it. March brings St. Patrick's Day, which is also known as the Overdrinking Academy Awards. St. Patrick's Day is supposed to be an ethnic celebration based on the English saint who converted Ireland to Christianity and drove the snakes out. It usually feels like sanctioned binge drinking. They say everyone is Irish on St. Patrick's Day, and I'm starting to think that is most certainly not a compliment. I always imagine St. Patrick looking down from heaven, mumbling, "What are they doing? I hated beer." Some of the overconsumption of alcohol on St. Patrick's Day is a function of the Irish stereotype of a love of drinking, but I think it has even more to do with how bad corned beef and cabbage taste. I'm an American of Irish heritage. You may recall earlier that I mentioned the St. Patrick's Day tradition of my childhood, that we would eat corned beef and cabbage for dinner. After that, my mom would encourage my siblings and me to go into the yard looking for a leprechaun. If we caught a leprechaun, we would supposedly get a pot of gold. I realize now she probably just wanted some time alone so she could eat something delicious that was not corned beef and cabbage. Even she knew she made it wrong. It's strange being an Irish American. Alcohol is woven into the ethnic pride. As a teenager, I felt pressure to like Guinness. It's an acquired taste, but Guinness is presented to the Irish American as being as familiar as mother's milk. This is probably because Guinness has the same chemical composition as your Irish American mother's milk. As a teenager, I remember thinking, I want to like this, but I don't see it happening. Now I sometimes enjoy a Guinness, but I'm not crazy about the weight. You could write the entire Guinness World Records book while you wait for a Guinness to be poured in a bar. Often instead of ordering a Guinness, I'll just tell the bartender I'd like to wait an hour for my beer. He knows what I mean. Second quarter. Spring is a period of renewal. To celebrate this period of joy and rebirth, I eat candy. Easter is one of the most sacred holidays for Christians, yet the rituals always felt very strange to me. I don't understand where most holiday traditions came from, but the egg seems to play a particularly confusing role at Easter. I always imagine how the conversation occurred.
Easter is the day Jesus rose from the dead. What should we do? How about eggs? What does that have to do with Jesus? All right, we'll hide them. I don't follow your logic.
Don't worry, there's a bunny.
It's not just the involvement of eggs that makes Easter tradition so bizarre. It's also the absurdity of letting young children handle the fragile eggs. Thank God the colorful eggs are hard-boiled because, wait for it, little kids break eggs. Kids can't even dye the eggs without breaking them. Every year on the Thursday before Easter, Jeannie and I dye hard-boiled eggs with our young children. Let's just say there's usually a lot of egg salad eaten on Good Friday. To make matters more interesting, since we live in New York City, Jeannie and I hide the remaining unbroken eggs in our apartment and then ask our children to find them. That's right, we voluntarily embrace the great likelihood of a rotten egg being hidden in our small, smell-friendly apartment. Painting eggs and looking for them is amusing. But like most 5-year-olds, I focus on the more unique Easter food. Chocolate bunnies, chocolate eggs, and of course, Peeps, which are the candy corn of Easter. Nostalgia is the only thing keeping Peeps in circulation. Fact, stale Peeps are far better than fresh Peeps. So take care to break the plastic wrap the night before Easter to allow for appropriate hardening. I'm talking the night before Easter, a year before the Easter you plan to eat them. Recently, Americans started celebrating Cinco de Mayo. Perhaps less out of respect for the large number of Mexican Americans here, and more to provide an excuse to have a party in May. Cinco de Mayo serves as an almost sequel to St. Patrick's Day, but instead of just binging on alcohol, we overconsume alcohol and food. Excitement for spring and the fact that tacos, burritos, enchiladas, and pretty much all Mexican foods are some of the greatest things on this planet made Cinco de Mayo an inevitable American holiday. In a lot of ways, the American celebration of Cinco de Mayo feels like a marketing stunt by the makers of Corona beer and old El Paso products. For some reason I don't understand, Cinco de Mayo always seems to be on or around the 5th of May. Third quarter. During summer, the weather is nice, which means people love to eat outside. To kick off these warmer months, Americans observe Memorial Day to honor the heroes who gave their lives for this country, and more important, to celebrate the first day they can break out their grill. This love of grilling and picnicking is most notable on Independence Day, the day we as a country became free to eat whatever we wanted. The 4th of July is another fine example of how we use the holidays as an excuse to overeat.
Normally, I don't eat a burger, a brat, and a steak, but it is 4th of July, and I'm going to need the energy if I'm going to be blowing things up. Besides, that's what the Founding Fathers would want.
August feels like a month-long rehearsal of how we will barbecue, eat, and celebrate Labor Day. Fourth quarter. My favorite holiday is Halloween, and not just because women use it as an excuse to dress like prostitutes. You ladies totally do. I'm a witch, if she was a hooker. I'm Little Miss Muffet. I'm sure you are. A cautionary note. Never shop with your children for their Halloween costumes online. You're sitting there with your 4-year-old daughter and Google Little Red Riding Hood costume. And what comes up looks like it should be on the cover of an X-rated video. Not that I would know what a cover of an X-rated video would look like. No, Halloween is my favorite because it is the ultimate candy holiday. When you're a kid, Halloween is amazing. You dress like a superhero, you bang on your neighbor's door, and they give you candy. I do that today, and my neighbor wants me arrested, probably because I make such a hot cat woman. Brrr, kitty wants some candy. Pumpkin, the only real food associated with Halloween, is purely decorative. People buy pumpkins around Halloween, but it's never to eat them. When someone wants pumpkin bread or muffins or a pumpkin pie, they go to the bakery. It is way too disgusting to try to obtain actual food out of a raw pumpkin. Who the heck gets hungry while scooping out that nasty tangled mess? Hannibal Lecter? In our family, we always try to roast the slimy seeds. but they just turn into burnt, overly salted choking hazards that scrape your intestines for the next 2 weeks after eating them. We only buy pumpkins to make jack-o'-lanterns. Let's carve this healthy food up into a scary face and let it rot while we eat some candy. Thanksgiving is uniquely an American holiday. Sure, Canadians have a Thanksgiving, but I think theirs is in October or something. Weirdos. I don't think they even have a 4th of July. Thanksgiving is tended to be about gratitude, a day of gratitude. Thank God there's a day for us to focus on being grateful, because I'd hate the idea of being grateful year-round. We express this gratitude by over-consuming turkey, an enormous assortment of side dishes, and of course pies. There is very little complexity in the concept of the Thanksgiving holiday. It seems as if very little effort went into the planning.
How about Thanksgiving, we just eat a lot?
But in America, we do that every day.
Well, what if we eat a lot with people who annoy the hell out of us?
Thanksgiving is all about overeating. Even one of the main dishes is actually called stuffing. Stuffing! What names did they turn down? Cram it in? Eat till you can't breathe? In some parts of the country, people call stuffing dressing. Actually, the term stuffing makes a lot more sense than dressing, which normally refers to something done externally rather than internally. By calling it dressing instead of stuffing, it almost seems as if they're purposely hiding the location where the dish is actually cooked. It's borderline dishonest. Here's your dressing, wink. Admittedly, I'm not completely comfortable with the fact that stuffing, or dressing, is in reality cooked inside a dead animal. I'm not sure how this is supposed to be appetizing. We are basically shoving a loaf of bread up the carcass of a turkey. This is a rather humiliating thing to do to anything after it dies. Talk about an outrage of personal dignity. I hope the turkeys never find out about this practice of stuffing.
Turkey, you guys are going to kill me? Oh, it's going to get a lot worse.
The Thanksgiving meal represents the opening day of the holiday season, and it is a very unprofessional season at that. Santa may be watching, but nobody is being good in December. Christmas is like the Las Vegas of holiday eating. From the moment December begins, you get a free pass to overindulge. There's even candy in Advent calendars. Regardless of your faith or belief system, all Americans find themselves invited to a never-ending buffet of holiday parties. All dietary rules are suspended. You navigate your way through each day facing an onslaught of hors d'oeuvres, the French phrase for trays of fattening stuff no one can identify. Cookies, cakes, and candies are exchanged with friends for virtually no reason at all. During December, we are all ingesting, imbibing, and spending with a reckless abandon, like a bachelor party on a guilt-free boondoggle. Everyone has the unspoken agreement that what happens in December stays in December. If Christmas consumption doesn't kill or bankrupt you, you get one more chance on New Year's Eve, the prom night of holidays. New Year's Eve is the pinnacle of the alcohol overconsumption category, but it is also the culmination of all the indulging of the entire year in a final fit of hedonistic madness. It's the overconsuming of overconsumption. The pressure is on. We get one last hurrah before we head back to the war of regular life and responsible living. Over the course of December's gluttonous rampage, we've committed to turn over a new leaf come January. We can't go on like this. We can be healthy, but only if we get one last night, one last drink, one last piece of cake, one last cigarette. Like the frog prince, a kiss at midnight from her sweetheart will turn us into a new person, and poof, it's a new year. Fourth quarter. I start off the year with the best intentions. It's a new year filled with hope and possibility. Family dinner. When I was growing up, every Sunday my family would have a family dinner. Sunday dinner, or as I called it, torture, was my parents' attempt at being civilized and having at least one meal a week with the entire family. Mom, Dad, and the six kids would gather around the dining room table. There was no getting out of it. My friend's mom could offer to take me to meet Jesus, and I wouldn't be able to go. It was family time, and I remember hating it. There was a formal dress requirement. Well, not formal, but more fancy, so wearing scratchy clothes was a necessity. The dinner had to take place in the dining room, and my mom had to use her wedding china that was so nice it could never go into a dishwasher. It had to be carefully washed by hand, and preferably dried with a kitten, and it had to be a white kitten. Sunday dinner would start around 6 p.m. We would say grace to thank God for all his blessings. Then we would try to rip each other apart over the first serving as my mother yelled orders at us from the other room. She never had time to eat. She would be scooting back and forth, combining elegance and warmth with absolute frustration. "Eat the coleslaw!" would be bellowed from the other room. My dad would hack a productive smoker's cough before he began every sentence.
"This is great, Marcia,"
my dad would mumble as he slid a carving knife into a pork roast, a turkey, or a rack of lamb. He would use a low voice as if to indicate to the rest of us,
"Compliment your mother or you die."
My siblings and I would quickly chime in with, "It's great, thanks, Mom." Then a silence would fall over the table as bowls and plates were passed and food was voraciously consumed. I remember being a kid and never being able to find a multi-course meal appealing. I couldn't understand why we couldn't just have McDonald's for Sunday dinner. My 8-year-old palate was already accustomed to fast food, and expanding it beyond that has been a lifelong struggle for me. My mom could make thick and juicy home-cooked hamburgers on some fancy roll, but I still preferred a thin, tasteless McDonald's hamburger on that Wonder Bun. At the end of dinner, my dad would light a cigarette, yes, in the same room with all six of his kids, and begin a discussion that to me always seemed like awkward small talk.
"Someone," one of the kids, "broke the clicker, remote control. Or, someone we don't know is dying, so we should all feel horrible. Or even worse, what do you want to be when you grow up?"
As a 10-year-old, I remember announcing, "Mike said I'd be a great proctologist." Now, I had no idea what it was, but I figured out I'd said something wrong when everyone laughed at me, and my dad gave me the dead-eye stare. Occasionally, my father would ask us about historical events.
"Jimmy, what do you think of the Vietnam War?"
It didn't matter that the Vietnam War was long over, or that I was 10 years old at the time and pretty much unaware of the existence of Vietnam. I'm sure my answer was nothing very insightful, and probably pretty ignorant, much to the delighted mockery of my older siblings.
It seemed fun on MASH.
That was Korea, you idiot. Many of these Sunday night family discussions would inevitably lead to massive arguments, and normally someone would end up crying or getting punished. The punishment was pretty harsh and usually involved cleaning up after the Sunday dinner, which was the only thing worse than the actual Sunday dinner. Cleaning up after an 8-person Sunday dinner that you don't even want to be at should probably be added to the Amnesty International list of torture techniques. But we were dressed nicely, so it seemed like very civilized torture. It's no wonder I still love McDonald's. You can just eat it, then throw the bag away. Last Supper. Sitting and eating a meal with someone is intimate. I try to eat as many meals as I can with my kids. Sure, I try to eat as many meals as I can in general, but eating with my children is important. There we are together, eating and talking and spilling and throwing food. Sometimes my kids misbehave, too. It's a great time to force myself away from all the other distractions in my life and sit around a table sharing an experience with my family. Even baby Patrick in his high chair knows it's important. He laughs along and babbles in agreement. He is in the mix. The entire family is participating in something together. Jeannie and I try to teach manners and civilize these little monsters, but anyone with young children knows it's never a relaxing experience. It's just good to eat together. It's a unique time you can share with your family, and it's been going on for thousands of years. People of every culture have shared a family meal to commemorate their most important customs. On Passover, Jewish people eat lamb, bitter herbs, and unleavened bread in communion with their ancestors. It's pretty brilliant, really. Imagine if years from now people thought of you while they ate bratwurst. Well, on this day, we eat brats to honor Jim Gaffigan. Eating a meal with your family or friends to honor someone or something heightens the experience of eating, and eating heightens the experience of the tradition. It was on a Passover over 2,000 years ago that Jesus hosted the Last Supper. It was the Last Supper, not the Last Seminar, for a reason. Jesus was getting at least 12 men together. There had to be food.
Jesus, tomorrow I'd like to get everyone together.
Apostle, is there going to be food there?
Jesus, yes, there will be food.
Are we talking appetizers or like a meal?
It will be a supper.
A supper? So it's casual. I can wear a robe. I mean, if you said dinner, I'd wear a tie. I always found it odd that this momentous event was given such a seemingly casual name. The word supper sounds like a potluck with Jed Clampett as the party planner. I can just see Jed in his floppy hat. Hey, y'all, Jesus is having a last supper. Let's rustle up some grub. Sissy, you bring your jello salad. Jesus will fry up the fish. I'll be playing fiddle.
I'm sure the Last Supper was anything but casual. It was the last meal Jesus shared with his apostles before things got really messy. Anyone who has organized a gathering with a large group of friends know this is never an easy task. Even if you are not about to be crucified, no matter how intimate the event is, there is always someone who shows up at your dinner party with uninvited strangers. You know one of the apostles arrived in this manner. Hey, Jesus! Happy Last Supper. Hope it's okay, but I brought my friends Frank and Wheezy. They're visiting from Cleveland, and they are huge fans of yours. Is it okay if they get a selfie with you? Of course, at the Last Supper, there was no jello salad or people from Cleveland. It took place in the Middle East, and given Jewish dietary laws, the bread Jesus broke and shared with his apostles was probably not that tasty and had all the leaven taken out. Think how different things could have been if the Last Supper had occurred in Mexico. Jesus probably would have said, take this, all of you, but not the chips. I'm saving those for the guacamole. We all know the importance of guacamole. Now, I know the Last Supper did not occur at a Mexican restaurant or in any type of restaurant in the modern sense of the word, although I love the idea of an interrupting waitress at this momentous event.
Take this, all of you.
Can I get anyone coffee?
We're good, thank you.
Dessert? We have a key lime pie to die for.
Just the check, please.
I'm going to bring you guys a slice of the pie with a bunch of forks on the house, huh? You only live once, right?
Something like that.
I hope I haven't offended anyone with my lighthearted take on the Last Supper. I certainly don't mean to offend. I understand that religion jokes make some people uncomfortable, especially the people that are going to hell. It is my belief that God has a great sense of humor. How else would you explain the appearance of the duck-billed platypus or the manatee? Doesn't it look like God didn't try very hard on the manatee? Let's see, make him a gray blob of fat, flip-flops, what the heck, let's go with a goatee. Stick him around Florida, he'll fit right in.
The final meal. I have 5 young, energetic children whom I love with every ounce of my existence and who, I always joke, are going to be the death of me. Whoever said kids keep you young was being sarcastic. The reality is that eventually we are all going to die, even though no one wants to think about it. Whenever the news tells us someone famous has passed away, we always think to ourselves, I'm glad that's never happening to me. But when you have kids, you have to start talking about wills and life insurance and all other kinds of morbid stuff. So you're forced to acknowledge that death eventually will happen. Whenever I am confronted with the thought of death, I am faced with the same perplexing question that has puzzled both philosophers and religious leaders since the beginning of time. What do I eat for my last meal? Supposedly, death row inmates get to request a last meal before we take their lives. Often these criminals have done horrible things, so it's kind of confusing to me that we are executing them, but just beforehand offering them a little treat, as if it somehow makes taking their lives more civilized. Suddenly, we as a society are like a James Bond villain. Before I kill you with my evil contraption, would you like some caviar? Most of us don't know when or how we are going to go, so for us non-death row inmates, the last meal question presents an interesting conundrum. How do we plan? I don't like to have forgettable meals in normal circumstances. Even worse than that are the meals that are bad or unsatisfying. You wouldn't want to spend the afterlife regretting your last meal. I can't believe I ordered the fish.
What was I doing eating applesauce from White Castle? We want to leave the people here with the knowledge that we have loved them dearly, but also that we have no regrets and have lived our lives to their fullest. Therefore, I conclude that we should be full, full of something delicious. Jeannie told me the Bible says that the kingdom of heaven is like a wedding feast. But what if I'm not invited? I figure I'd like to do some carb loading to increase my stamina for when I have to start the heavy negotiating with St. Peter. I'm sure I will be standing outside the ropes. I know my wife's in there, and I'm almost positive she got me on the list. No, maybe, could you just give her my mobile number?
If I could just talk to her, I'm sure we could straighten this out.
Her name's Jeannie. She might be going by St. Jeannie up here. But how to plan the last meal? For the answer to this age-old question, I needed only to turn to my brilliant and funny peers. Most of the great advice I've received in my life I've gotten from fellow comedians. Sure, we are a ragtag bunch of self-destructive narcissists, but there is an inherent bravery and wisdom found in stand-up comedians. Comedians examine life from a unique point of view. There are so many influences I could mention, but really each of my stand-up comedian friends and predecessors has taught me so many things. Once a friend told me he tried to treat every performance like it might be his last. Similar to the football coach instructing players to give 100% or leave everything on the field. It is always possible any stand-up performance could be your last, so make sure it matters. No comedian would want his last performance to be uninspired or phoned in. I think unconsciously I've always applied this advice to my eating. I'd never want my last real meal to be a kale salad or a power bar. Maybe this whole eat every meal like it's your last approach to life is really what inspired me to write this book. My advice to you, dear listener, is to eat well and eat frequently. Our time here is pretty short. It's filled with disappointment and drama, and food can make it better. I'm not proposing that every meal should be a Shake Shack burger or a falafel from Mamoun's on McDougal Street, but it is important that you enjoy your life. That's why a decent cheeseburger is always a good decision. Yes, I'm saying that a cheeseburger and fries would be a great last meal. Make it a double. Since we don't know how or when we will go, I make it a point to eat a few cheeseburgers throughout the day, just in case. I am a firm believer that the meal should always fit the occasion. So I also have suggestions for last meals, depending on the way you go, just in case you are a planner and also a clairvoyant. If you are going to go down in a private jet, I would suggest a Kobe beefsteak dinner. If you are murdered by a junkie, your last meal should be a donut. If you are fatally hit by a foul ball at a baseball game, you should be eating a hot dog. If you die from a gunshot wound, you should be digesting Waffle House. If you are stabbed to death in jail, it should be over a bologna sandwich. If you have a heart attack watching a football game, you should be reaching for a brat at the time. If you die from dysentery, it should be from a Hot Pocket. If you take your own life, it should be after you ate kale, because you don't deserve a good last meal if you do that. If you die abroad, may it be in Mexico or Thailand after an amazing feast. And of course, if you choke to death, it should be on bacon. Thank you, my friends, for listening to this book. I hope your worst eating experiences are behind you. May you enjoy only great meals, mostly with family and close friends. I hope your coffee is strong, your cheese is sharp, and your guacamole is chunky. This is my wish for all of you. But most important, I hope you don't dance. People look really silly doing that. Am I right or what? This is Jim Gaffigan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Food, A Love Story. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt. Producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2014 by moi, Jim Gaffigan. Production copyright 2014, Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.